Radicalism, 1760 to 1780. Although popular participation in politics had declined somewhat during the reigns of the first two Georges, the English radical tradition could not be obliterated. There was a vigorous resistance to ruling cartels and an overwhelming sense of liberty and freedom amongst the English. These included ideas like freedom before the law, including trial by jury, habeas corpus, religious toleration, and property rights. Any attempts to extend standing armies, erect military barracks, or centralise the police forces or tax collection met with fierce resistance. The rebirth of political radicalism in the 1750s and 1760s has been attributed to the increase in industrialisation and urbanisation. However, this economic and social interpretation of the rise of radicalism has been challenged by historians from the Tory school, who see an overtly political motive for the increase in radical activity after the accession of George III. The initial forays into radicalism after 1760 were centred on the City of London. And in particular, we can focus on the Wilkes Affair as an example of this increased radical activity. Wilkes was of middle class extraction. He was educated as a gentleman and married a Buckinghamshire heiress. He entered Parliament in 1757. He had tremendous wit and charm, although he was not a great public speaker. Above all, he was a publicist of immense skill, and he cultivated the press by associating himself with the cause of liberty. The Wilkite movement, though, was far more than the character of Wilkes himself, and Wilkes told George III that he was not a Wilkite. He provided the focus for the discontent amongst the middle classes of London and elsewhere. From 1762, Wilkes had been carrying on a campaign against Bute in his paper The North Briton. In particular, issue number 45 of The North Briton contained a trenchant attack on Bute and the peace treaties. This led to the establishment taking action against him. Wilkes was arrested, but this happened whilst he was an MP and was found by the courts to be a breach of parliamentary privilege. Thus, the ministry, with the support of the Commons, directed he should be expelled from his seat. Legal proceedings continued against him and in particular pursued him for debts, so he fled to the continent, returning in 1767-8, beginning his campaign to be again elected to Parliament. He first stood for London, but was unsuccessful, and then for Middlesex, where he swept the poll. His election sparked off riots and demonstrations in London, and these came to a head in May 1768, when a crowd gathered in St George's Fields and was shot on by troops. A number of protesters were killed. Wilkes was ejected from his seat at Middlesex, but as often as the government expelled him, the people re-elected him, until the government was forced to declare the candidate with a minority of votes elected. In December, Sergeant John Glynn, Wilkes's counsel in his libel trial, succeeded in a by-election in Middlesex, and support for Wilkes was at its zenith when he stood as an alderman for London, polling 1,300 out of 1,500 votes. Support for Wilkes spread outside London, and there were 55,000 signatures on petitions in support of his cause. Thus, after 1769, public opinion began to matter in politics, and the nationwide political network developed by Wilkes' supporters provided a legacy for the reformers of the next generation. There are a number of prints and pamphlets and cartoons portraying popular Wilkite politics. In particular, popular plebeian politics is seen as in anti-Wilkite images as forms of disorder. There is a disparagement of the humble man's desire to exceed their station and emulate the rich. And this propaganda is an important factor in the development of radicalism in the public imagination. The second major event that encouraged radicalism is the American War. The British North Atlantic Empire in the mid-18th century consisted of 8 island colonies in the Atlantic and Caribbean, and 13 provinces on the eastern seaboard of America, with a population of around 1.25 million whites and a further 250,000 blacks, most of whom were concentrated in the coastal areas of Virginia. The policy of the British government towards the colonies was protectionist. The objective was to make the empire strong, economically and militarily self-sustaining, in a world of competing powers, amongst which that of France appeared particularly formidable. The colonies were prosperous by the mid-century. The financial burden of government was light, and local taxation was negligible or non-existent. Capital was available for economic expansion from Britain, but much came from within the colonies themselves. British administrative control of the colonies suffered from a division of responsibility between different departments of state. Parliament did legislate regularly for the colonies, but mostly in the fields of trade and navigation. And this was relatively uncontentious because the economy was prospering and successful. However, representative government was viewed as a right that should be enjoyed. The origins of the American Revolution came with the Anglo-French 9 Years' War of 1754 to 63. In 1763, a peace treaty was finally negotiated in which the French gave up all claims to territory on the American mainland, seemingly safeguarding the future of Britain's Atlantic Empire. But during the war, tensions crystallised, eventually leading to its violent collapse. The most significant result of the war was to move competing territorial claims from other European powers. Thus, the colonists' sense of dependence on Britain was lessened. A second problem was the issue of colonial currency. Each province had its own currency, which could be exchanged for sterling, and this brought problems of credit and debt, inflation and evasion of paying British taxes in sterling, all of which the British government tried to control. The third problem raised by the Anglo-French War was the issue of defending and financing a war thousands of miles from the central power base. Fourthly, the colonial assemblies exploited the emergency to win further powers for themselves. And finally, the war provoked new contentions over trade. In Britain, an effective post-war policy was one of the major concerns of the British government. Two problems were needed to be addressed: the government and defence of the new territories and the provision of funds for those services. In Britain, high taxes were raised to pay for the costs of war, but in America, domestic taxation was insignificant. Thus, the British government tried to enforce customs duties on goods entering America. The second part was to introduce some colonial taxation via the Stamp Act of 1765. The Act was passed with the opposition of only 50 MPs. The funds collected were to be used in America. The Rockingham government chose to adopt a conciliatory tone with the colonists, repealing the Stamp Act, but at the same time passing a declaratory act which said that the British legislature had, hath, and of right ought to have full power and authority to make laws and statutes of sufficient force and validity to bind the colonies and peoples of America, subjects of the Crown of Great Britain, in all cases whatsoever. Rockingham's conciliatory policies were replaced by a new administration led by Chatham. The new Chancellor of the Exchequer, Townshend, provoked a fresh crisis with his Revenue Act of 1767, which placed duties on a variety of commodities. He also established an American Board of Customs at Boston. Resistance to Townshend's Act surpass a defiance to the Stamp Act. In the spring of 1769, it was agreed by Parliament to abolish all the Townshend duties except that on tea. In Britain, there was no willingness to repeal unless a clear admission of subordination was first given by the colonists. The colonial politicians refused to consider this concession, and thus the course was set for full-scale confrontation. The catalyst to the conflict was in Boston. In 1770, there were a series of incidents which led finally to the so-called Boston Massacre. In 1773, a Tea Act was passed to help the East India Company disperse large stocks of tea. This led to the famous Boston Tea Party of December 1773, when three shiploads of tea were dumped overboard before they could be landed at Boston. This time, ministers felt they could not yield. During the early months of 1774, they brought before Parliament a string of bills known as the Coercive or Intolerable Acts, and the enforcement of these acts finally led to the Revolutionary War. By the summer of 1776, British administration everywhere had been replaced by ad hoc provincial governments, and on the 4th of July, Congress adopted the resolution that the colonies be declared independence. The war continued with little British success, due largely to mismanagement and remoteness from central command and supply, until peace was negotiated in late 1782. O'Gorman takes the view that the loss of the American colonies was in the end a British national responsibility. The King, the Houses of Parliament, and a large portion of public opinion supported the policy that the American colonies should be subjected to the will of Parliament. The conflict has arisen about differences of opinions about what rights the American colonists held. The war also had a profound impact upon British political culture, centering on the debates about the nature of law and liberty, the meaning of patriotism, and the role of the people. Firstly, it was an important event in radical politics, and encouraged the case for parliamentary reform that had been set in train by the Wilkes Affair. Secondly, such arguments were bound up with a rethinking of empire, giving support for the anti-imperialists, who argue that empire was a primary source of national luxury and corruption. Thirdly, for those who supported the government during the war, the American debacle provided chilling evidence of the results of too conciliatory and permissive an imperial policy. The arguments surrounding the war also fed into the political ideology of especially the Rockinghamite Whigs, but also gave a new patriotic dimension to the emerging Tory interest in Parliament. And fifthly, the war in part influenced a crisis in Ireland. To conclude then, were these reform and agitation movements really radical? The reformers' ideal was a broad propertied oligarchy in which the lower orders should accept their place. They sought to make the commons more representative, but had no wish to curb the powers of the monarchy or parliament. They did not envisage any great redistribution of wealth. Thus, was this radicalism progressive, or was it backward-looking? In some ways, they were innately conservative movements concerned with the restoration, as they saw it, of a mythical balance of power that had existed after 1688. The mob also played a peripheral role in the disquiet of the period, and often took to the streets for reasons other than political ones. However, radicalism before 1790 did have a profound effect on internal British politics, the empire, foreign affairs, and Ireland, and it is against this backdrop that we now go on to look at the consequences in Britain of the revolution in France.